Next door resides the so-called Action Committee, where big money and support are mustered and promises traded. What promises is still half a mystery to me, though Sid once spoke of a plan to fill the ancient harbour with cement and make a car park of it, to the pleasure of many influential contractors. Abruptly, Mr. Muspole rings off. Without a sound, Pym swivels on his heel and prepares to beat an orderly retreat down the stairs. He is saved by the whir of Mr. Muspole dialing again. He is talking to a lady, asking tender questions and purring at the answers. Muspole can carry on like this for hours. It is his little pleasure. Having waited till his voice has settled to a reassuring flow, Pym returns to the ground floor. The darkness of the committee room smells of tea and deodorant. The door to the courtyard is locked from the inside. Pym softly turns the key and pockets it. The cellar staircase stinks of cat. Boxes are stored on the steps. Groping his way down, unwilling to put on the light lest it be visible from the courtyard, Pym has a mental reprise of a day in Bern when he carried his damp washing down the stone steps to another cellar and was scared of tripping over Herr Bastl. And as he reaches the bottom step, he does indeed miss his footing. Lurching forward, he falls heavily onto the cellar door and pushes it open with both hands as he tries to steady himself. The door screeches in the grime. The impetus of his body is enough to carry him into the cellar, which to his surprise is lit by a pale light. By its glow, Pym makes out the green filing cabinet, and standing before it, a woman, holding what appears to be a chisel, examining its locks by the ailing beam of a bicycle lamp. Her eyes, which are turned to him, are dark and pugnacious. There is not a flicker of guilt about her. And it is a thing I wonder at still, that it never seriously occurred to him to doubt that she was the same woman, with the same gaze, and the same intense and disapproving quietness, whose veiled face had fixed on him after his triumph on the hustings of Little Chedworth, and stalked him through a dozen meetings since. Even asking her name, Pym realizes that he knows it already, though he is blessed with no faculty of premonition. She wears a long skirt that could have been her mother's. She has a hard, pebble face and young hair turned to grey. Her eyes are disconcertingly straight and bright, even in the gloom. "My name is Peggy Wentworth," she replies defiantly in a tough Irish brogue. "Shall I spell it for you, Magnus? Peggy, short for Margaret, have you heard that? Your father, Mr. Richard Thomas Pym, killed my husband John, and as good as killed me too. And if it takes me the rest of my living death till they put me in the grave beside him, I'll find the proof of it, and bring the brute to justice." Seeing a flicker of moving light, Pym glances sharply behind him. Mattie Searle is standing in the doorway, with a blanket over his shoulders. His head is hung sideways to favour his good ear, while he squints, first at Pym, then at Peggy, over the top of his spectacles. How much has he heard? Pym has no idea, but his mind is made fertile by alarm. "This is Emma from Oxford, Matty," he says boldly. "Emma, this is Mr. Searle, who owns the hotel." "Pleased to meet you," says Peggy calmly. "Emma and I are in a college play next month, Matty. She came up to Gulworth so that we could rehearse together. We thought we'd be out of your way down here." "Oh, yes," says Matty. His eyes slip from Peggy to Pym and back again, with a knowledge that makes nonsense of Pym's lies. They hear his lazy shuffle going up the stairs. "I can't tell you very accurately any more, Tom, which bit she told Pym where." His first thought on escaping the hotel was to keep going, so they hopped a bus and went as far as it took them, which turned out to be the oldest, most broken-down bit of waste dockland you could imagine. Gutted warehouses with windows you could see the moon through. Idle cranes that rose like gallows straight out of the sea. A bunch of roving knife-bladers had pitched camp there. They must have worked at night and slept by day, because I remember their Romany faces rocking over their wheels as they trod their treadles, and the sparks gushing over the watching children. I remember girls with men's muscles flinging fish baskets, while they yelled ribaldries at each other, and fishermen strutting among them in their oilskins, too grand to be bothered with anyone but themselves. I remember with a leap of gratitude every flash of face or voice outside the windows of the prison she had locked me in with her relentless monologue. At a tea stall on the waterfront, while they stood shivering with a crowd of down-and-outs, Peggy told Pym the story of how Rick had stolen her farm. She had begun it the moment they got on the bus, for the benefit of anyone who'd care to hear it, and had continued it without a comma or a full stop since. And Pym knew that it was all true, all terrible, even if quite often the sheer venom in her drove him secretly to Rick's protection. They walked to get warm, but she didn't stop talking for one second. When he bought her beans and egg at a seaman's mission hut called the Rover, she still went on talking, as she spread her elbows and sawed the toast, and used her teaspoon to get up the sauce. It was at the Rover that she told Pym about Rick's great trust fund that took possession of the £9,000 of insurance money paid to her husband John after he fell into the thresher and lost both legs below the knee and all the fingers of one hand. As she told this part, she drew the lines of amputation on her own scant limbs without looking at them, and Pym sensed her obsession again and was scared of it. "The one voice I never did for you, Tom, is Peggy's Irish brogue dropping into Rick's chapel cadences as she repeated his silver-tongued promises. 12.5% plus profits, my dear, year in and year out. Enough to see dear old John right for as long as he's spared, and enough for yourself when he's gone. And enough left over after that, my dear, to put some by for that first-rate boy of yours, for when he goes to college and reads his law, just the way my own son will. They're birds of a feather." It was a Thomas Hardy story that she told, full of casual disasters that seemed to have been timed by an angry god to obtain the maximum of misfortune. And she was Hardy's woman to go with it, lured forward by her obsession, and only her own destiny left to deal with. John Wentworth, as well as being a victim, was an ass, she explained, and was ready to be swayed by the first charmer who walked into the room. He went to his grave convinced that Rick was a saviour and a pal. His farm was a Cornish manor called Tamar Rose, where every grain of wheat had to be wrestled from the sea wind. He had inherited it from a wiser father, and Alistair, their son, was his only heir. When John died, there was not a penny for anybody. "Everything signed away, every bloody thing mortgaged to the neck, Magnus." On which word, Peggy passed her bean-stained knife across her throat. She told about Rick visiting John in hospital soon after his accident, and the flowers and the chocolates and the bubbly, and Pym, in his mind's eye, saw the basket of black market fruit beside his own hospital bed when he woke up after his operation. He remembered Rick's noble caring for the aged and decrepit that he had helped him with during the war years of the Great Crusade. He remembered Lipsy's sobbing voice calling Rick a thief, and Rick's letters to her promising to see her right. "And a free train ticket for myself," Peggy is saying, "to come up to Truro Hospital to visit him. And your father driving me home after, Magnus. Nothing too much trouble for him until he has our man's money. The documents he made John sign, Magnus, always witnessed by the prettiest nurses. How your father always had the patience for John, always explaining to him whatever he couldn't understand, over and again if necessary. But John won't listen. The deluded man is too trusting and lazy in his mind." A fit of fury seizes her. "Me, up at 4 in the morning for the milking and falling asleep over me accounts at midnight," she shouts, as sleepy heads turn to her from other tables. "And that stupid husband of mine lying warm in his bed in Truro, signing it all away behind me back, while your father sits by his bedside playing the saint to him, Magnus. And my Alistair needing a pair of shoes to walk to school in, while you're living on the hog there with your fine schools and your fine clothes, Magnus, God save you." For it turns out, of course, on John's death, that for reasons outside everyone's control, the great trust fund has suffered a purely temporary problem of liquidity, and can't pay the 12.5% plus profits after all. It can't refund the capital either. And that to tide everyone over this sticky patch, John Wentworth took the wise precaution, just before his death, of mortgaging the farm and land and livestock, and bloody nearly his wife and child as well, so that nobody will ever want for anything again, and had given the proceeds to his dear old pal, Rick, and that Rick has brought down a distinguished lawyer, name of Loft, all the way from London with him, just to explain the implications of this smart move to John on his deathbed. And John to please everyone as usual, has written out a special long letter, all in his own hand, assuring whom it may concern that his decision has been taken while he was of sound mind and in full possession of his mental faculties, and was not in any way subjected to undue influence by a saint and his lawyer while he was lying gasping out his last. All this in case Peggy, or for that matter Alistair, should later have the bad manners to dispute the document in court, or try to get John's £9,000 back, or should otherwise show a lack of faith in Rick's selfless stewardship of John's ruin. "When did all this happen?" says Pym. She tells him the dates. She tells him the day of the week and the hour of the day. She pulls a wad of letters from her handbag, signed by Peirce, and regretting that our chairman, Mr. R.T. Pym, is unavailable, being absent indefinitely on a mission of national necessity, and assuring her that the documents relating to the freehold of Tamar Rose are at present being processed with a view to acquiring a large figure in your interest. And she watches him with her mad, cold eyes as he reads them by the light of a street lamp while they sit huddled on a broken bench. She takes back the letters and returns them to their envelopes, lovingly, careful of the edges and the folds. As she continues talking, Pym wants to close his ears or slap a hand over her mouth. He wants to get up and run to the sea wall and throw himself over. He wants to scream, "Shut up!" But all he does is ask her, "Please, I beg you, if you would be so kind, don't continue with your story." "Why not, pray?" "I don't want to hear it. It's not my business, this part. He robbed you. The rest doesn't make any difference," says Pym. Peggy doesn't agree. She is flailing her Irish back with her Irish guilt and using Pym's presence as the excuse to do it. She is talking in a gush. It is what she has been waiting to tell him best. "And why not? Seeing as the bloody man possesses you anyway. If he's already got his filthy arms around you, sure as if he had you in his fancy bed with the frills and the fancy mirrors." It is Rick's bedroom in Chester Street she is describing. "Seeing as he's already got the power of life and death over you, and you're a foolish, lonely woman in the world, with a sickly boy to care for, and a bankrupt farm to mind, and not a soul but the stupid bailiff to say nice day to for a week at a time. It's enough to know he's done you wrong," Pym insists. "Please, Peggy, the rest is private. Seeing as he can beckon you up to London first class, send the tickets, just with a flick of his fingers the moment he gets back from his national necessity, because he thinks you're going to put the lawyers on him. Well, you go, don't you? If you haven't had a man for 2 years and more, and only your own body to look at, withering in the mirror every day, you go. I'm sure you do. I'm sure there was every reason," Pym says. "Please don't tell me any more." She is doing Rick's voice again. "Let's sort this matter out once and for all, Peggy, my dear. I'm not having a sour bit of business come between us when all I ever wanted was to see you right." "Well, you go, don't you?" Her voice is echoing in the empty square and out over the water. "My God, you go! You pack your bag, you take your boy and lock the door, because you're off to get your money and some justice. You scurry up there, bursting to have the fight of your life just the moment you set eyes on him. You leave the washing and the dishes and the milking and the penny-pinching life he's put you to. And you tell the stupid bailiff to mind the shop for you. Me and Alistair, we're going up to London. And when you arrive, instead of a business conference with Mr. Percy Loft and Mr. Bloody Muspole and the gang of them, the man buys you fine clothes in Bond Street and treats you like a princess, with the limousines and the restaurants and the fancy petticoats and silks. Well, you can always have your row with him later, can't you?" "No," says Pym, "you can't. You got to have it then or never. If he's trodden you into the mud these years, the least you can do is get a bit back from him in exchange for all the misery. Take him for every penny he's robbed you of." Yet again she does Rick's voice. "I always fancied you, Peggy, you know that. You're a good scout, the best. Always had my eye on that pretty Irish smile of yours, and not only the smile either. So all right, he's got a treat prepared for the boy as well. Takes him to the arsenal, and we sit up there like gods in the special box, with the lords and grandees, and dinner at Quaglino's after. Him, the people's man, with a 2-foot cake with a boy's name written on it. You should see Alistair's face. And next day a Harley Street specialist laid on to listen to his cough, and a gold watch for the boy after, for being the brave one, with his initials on it. From RTP to a fine young man. Come to think of it, it's not at all unlike the one you're wearing now. Is that a gold one too? So, when a man's done all that for you, been a bastard, well, you have to admit to yourself after a couple of days of it, there's many worse bastards than him in the world. Most of them wouldn't split their bloody bath bun with you, let alone a 2-foot cake at Quaglino's, and somebody to take the boy home to bed after, so that the grown-ups can go to a nightclub and have a bit of fun. Why not, if he always fancied me? There's not many women wouldn't put off a fight for a day or two for some of that, I suppose. So why not? She is speaking as if Pym is no longer there, and she is right. She has deafened him, but he can still hear her. As I hear her still, an endless, needling babble of destruction. She is speaking to the derelict cattle market with its broken pens and stopped clock. But Pym is numb and dead and anywhere but here. He is in the overflow house at his prep school, and Rick's raised voice and Lipsy's weeping keep waking him in his sleep. He is on Dorothy's bed at the Glades, and bored to bloody death, with his head against her shoulder, staring at the white sky through the window all day long. He is in an attic somewhere in Switzerland, wondering to God why he has killed his friend to please an enemy. She is describing Rick's madness with her own. Her voice is a nagging, querulous torrent, and he hates it to distraction. The way the man boasted. He'd not a foot on the earth when he started with his lying. How he'd been Lady Mountbatten's lover, and she'd assured him he was better than Noel Coward. How they'd wanted him for ambassador in Paris, but he turned it down. He'd no patience with the airy fairies. And about the stupid green filing cabinet with his rotten secrets in it. Imagine the madness of a fellow who spends his hours weaving the rope they ought to hang him with. How he'd led her to it barefoot in her nightdress. Look at this, my child. The record, he called it. All the rights and wrongs he'd done. All the evidence of his innocence. His bloody righteousness. How, when he was judged, as judged he would surely be, everything in this stupid cabinet would be put into the balance, rights and wrongs together, and we would see him for what he was, up alongside of the angels, while us poor sinners down here bleed and starve for the glory of him. It's what he's put together to con the Almighty with, and that's the short of it. Imagine the impertinence! And him a bloody Baptist, too! Pym asks her how she has known where to find it. I saw the stupid thing being delivered, she says. I was keeping watch on Searle's Hotel the first day of the campaign. The pansy Kudlov drove it up specially in his limousine. The cost alone. The bastard Loft helped him carry it to the cellar. First time he's got his hands dirty. Rick didn't dare leave it in London while they were all up here. I have to put the proof on him, Magnus, she keeps repeating, as he leads her through the dawn to her miserable lodging house, her voice whining and insisting in his ear like a machine that nobody could stop. If he's got the proof there like he says, I'll have it off him and turn it back on him. I swear I will. All right, I've taken a drop of money off him, it's true. But what's the money when he's cheated me in love? What's the money when he can walk down the street a grandee? And there's my John rotting in his grave, and the people in the street all clapping for him, for Ricky Boy. And con his way to heaven into the bargain? What's the use of a poor deluded victim like me, who let him have his will with her and will burn in hell for it, if she won't do her duty by the world and point him up for the devil that he is? Where's the proof, I'm asking? Please stop, said Pym. I know what you want. Where's the justice? If he's got it there, I'll have it from him, thank you. I've no letters above a couple of procrastinators from Purse Loft. And what do they say? It's like trying to nail a raindrop to the wall, I tell you. Try to be calm now, Pym said. Please. I took myself to that stupid Lakin, the Tory. Half a day it took of waiting, but I got to him. Rick Pym's a shark, I told him. What's the good of telling that to a Tory, when they're all sharks anyway? I told the Labour, but they kept saying, what's he done? They said they'll inquire and thank you. But what will they find? The poor innocents. Matty Searle is sweeping the courtyard. Pym is indifferent to his scrutiny. Pym carries himself with authority, using the same walk that got him to Lipsy's bicycle, and passed the policeman to the overflow house. "I am authority. I am British. Will you kindly get out of my way?"
"I've left something in the cellar," he says, carelessly.
"Oh, yes," says Matty. Peggy Wentworth's bandsaw voice is cutting into his soul. What dreadful echoes has it woken in him? In what empty house of his childhood is it nagging and whining at him? Why is he so abject before its dredging insistence? She is the risen Lipsy, speaking out from the grave at last. She is the world inside my head, made strident. She is the sin I can never expiate. "Put your head in the basin, Pym. Hold these taps and listen to me, while I explain why no punishment will ever be enough for you. Put him on bread and water, his father's child. Why do you wet your bed, old son? Don't you know there's 1,000 quid in cash waiting for you at the end of your first dry year?" He switches on the committee room lights, throws open the door to the cellar steps, and stomps heavily down them. Cardboard boxes. Commodities. A glut to fill the shortages. Michael's dividers to the fore again, better than a Swiss penknife. He trips the lock of the green cabinet, and pulls out the first drawer as the glow begins to spread over him. Lipschitz, first name Anna. 2 volumes only. "Why, Lipsy, it's you at last," he thinks calmly. "Well, it was a short life, wasn't it? No time now, but rest where you are, and I'll come back and claim you later. Watermaster Dorothy, marital. 1 volume only. Well, it was a short marriage, too. But wait for me, Dot, for I've other ghosts I must attend to first." He closes the first drawer and pulls open the second. "Rick, you bastard, where are you?" Bankruptcy. The whole drawer full of it. He opens the third. The imminence of his discovery is setting his body on fire, the eyelids, the surfaces of his back and waist. But his fingers are light and quick and agile. "This is what I was born for, if I was born at all. I am God's detective, seeing everybody right. Wentworth, 12 of them, tagged in Rick's handwriting." Foremost in his mind, Pym has the dates of Muspel's letter, regretting Rick's absence for his national necessity. He remembers the fall and Rick's long, healthy holiday, while he and Dorothy were sweating out their imprisonment in the Glades. "Rick, you bastard, where were you? Come on, old son, we're pals, aren't we? In a minute I shall hear Herr Bastel barking." He opens the last drawer and sees Rex versus Pym, 1938, 3 fat files, and beside it Rex versus Pym, 1944, 1 only. He pulls out the first of the 1938 batch, replaces it, and selects the last instead. He turns to the final page first and reads the judge's summing up. Verdict, sentence, the immediate disposal of the prisoner. In calm ecstasy, he turns back to the beginning and starts again. No camera in those days, no copier, no tape recorders, only what you can see and hear and memorize and steal. He reads for an hour. A clock strikes 8, but it means nothing to him. "I am following my vocation. Divine service is in progress. You women want nothing but to drag us down." Matty is still sweeping the courtyard, but his outlines are blurred.
"Find it then," says Matty.
"Eventually, thanks, yes."
"That's the way then," says Matty.
He gains his bedroom, turns the key in the lock, pulls a chair to the washstand, starts writing. From the memory straight onto the paper, not a thought for style. He hears a knock, first timid, then louder, then a soft and pessimistic, "Magnus?" before the feet slowly descend the stairs. But Pym is at the heart of things. Women are abhorrent to him. Even Judy is irrelevant to his destiny. He hears her feet clip across the forecourt and the sound of her van driving away, slow at first, then suddenly much faster. Good riddance. "Dear Peggy," he is writing, "I hope that the enclosed will be of use to you." "Dear Belinda," he is writing,
I really must own to being fascinated by this glimpse of the democratic process at work. What seems at first to be such a rough instrument turns out to be equipped with all sorts of refined checks and balances. Do let's meet as soon as I return to London. Dearest Father, he is writing, today is Sunday, and in 4 days we shall know our fate and yours. But I do want you to know how much I have learned to admire the courage and conviction with which you have fought your arduous campaign. On the dais, Rick had not moved. His flick-knife stare was still fixed on Pym, yet he appeared calm. Nothing had happened behind him in the hall that could not be dealt with, apparently. His preoccupation was with his son, whom he was regarding with dangerous intensity. He was wearing his statesman's silver tie that night and a handmade shirt of cream silk with double cuffs and the great big RTP links from Aspreys. He had had his hair cut earlier in the day, and Pym could smell the barber's lotion as father and son continued to face each other. Once Rick's gaze switched to Muspole, and it was Pym's later impression Muspole nodded to him in some signal. The silence in the hall was absolute. No coughs or creaks that Pym could hear, not even from the old Nellies, whom Rick, as always, had appointed to the front row, where they could remind him of his dear mother and his beloved father who had died so many heroes' deaths. At last Rick turned and advanced towards the audience with the dutiful good-man Pym walk that so often preceded an act of particular hypocrisy. He reached the table but did not stop. He reached the microphone and switched it off. Let no machine come between us at this moment. He went on walking till he had reached the edge of the dais, at the point where it meets the fine curving staircase. He set his jaw. He looked out over the faces. He allowed his features to betray a moment's soul-searching before he set himself to speak. Somewhere on his way between Pym and the audience, he had unbuttoned his jacket. "Strike me here," he was saying. "Here is my heart." At last he spoke. His voice was higher than usual. Hear the emotion clenching it. "Would you mind repeating that question, please, Peggy? Very loudly, my dear, so that everyone can hear." Peggy Wentworth did as she was bidden, but as Rick's guest now, as well as his accuser. "Thank you, Peggy." Then he asked for a chair for her, so that she could sit down like everybody else. It was brought by Major Blenkinsop himself. Peggy sat on it in the aisle, obediently, a child in disgrace, waiting to hear some home truths. So it seemed to Pym, and still does, for I have long believed that everything Rick did this night was prepared in advance. If they had popped a dunce's cap on her head, Pym would not have been surprised. I believe they had seen Peggy haunting them, and Rick had laid out his mental defences in advance of her, as he had often done before. Muspole's people could have snatched her for the evening. Major Blenkinsop could have been advised she was not welcome inside the hall. There were a dozen ways in the court's book to keep a crazed and penniless little blackmailer like Peggy at bay for a crucial night. Rick used none of them. He wanted the trial, as ever. He wanted to be judged and found spotless. "Ladies and gentlemen, this lady's name is Mrs. Peggy Wentworth. She is a widow, whom I have known and tried to help for many years, who has been desperately wronged in life, and who blames me for her misfortune. I hope that after this meeting, you will all hear whatever Peggy has to tell you. Give her every indulgence at your command. Show her every patience. And in your wisdom, judge for yourselves where the truth may lie. I hope you will show charity to Peggy and to me, and remember how hard it is for all of us to accept misfortune without pointing the finger of blame." He placed his hands behind his back. His feet were close together. "Ladies and gentlemen, my old friend Peggy Wentworth is quite right." Not even Pym, who thought he knew all the instruments in Rick's orchestra, had heard him so straight and simple in his delivery, so bereft of rhetoric. "Many years ago, ladies and gentlemen, when I was a very young man, striving to get on in life, as we all were once, over-eager, ready to cut a few corners, I found myself in the position of the office boy who had borrowed a few stamps from the till and been caught before he had a chance to put them back. I was a first offender, it is true. My mother, like Peggy Wentworth here, was a widow. I had a great father to live up to and only sisters in the family. The responsibilities that weighed upon me, I will admit, blew me across the borders of what justice, in her blind wisdom, deemed right. Justice exacted her penalty. I paid it in full measure, as I shall pay for it all my life. Then the jaw went up, and the thick hands untied themselves, and one arm struck out towards the old Nellies in the front, while his eyes and voice reached into the darkness of the back. My friends, Peggy, my dear, I still count you as one too. My loyal friends of Gulworth North, I see among you here tonight men and women still young enough to be impulsive. I see others with the experience of life upon them, whose children and grandchildren have gone out into the world to follow their impulses, to strive and make mistakes and overcome them. I want to ask you older people this. If one of these young people, children, grandchildren, or if this son of mine who sits behind me here, poised to collect some of the highest prizes the law of this country can offer, if one of them should ever make a mistake and pay the price that society exacts and come home and say, "Mum, it's me. Dad, it's me." Which one of you sitting here among us tonight is going to slam the door in his face? They were standing. They were calling his name. "Ricky! Good old Ricky! You get our vote, Ricky boy!" On the dais behind him, we were standing too. And Pym saw through his own tears that Sid and Morrie were embracing each other. For once, Rick did not acknowledge the applause. He was casting round theatrically for Pym and calling, "Magnus, where are you, son?" though he knew perfectly well where he was. Affecting to find him, he seized his arm, raised it and drew him forward, almost lifting him off the ground, even as he offered him as champion to the jubilant crowd, shouting, "Here's one! Here's one!" I suppose he meant a penitent who has paid the price and come home, though I'll never be certain because of the roar, and perhaps he said, "Here's my son." As to Pym, he could no longer contain himself. He had never adored Rick more. He was choking and clapping, he was shaking Rick's hand for them with both of his, bear-hugging him and patting his great shoulder for them, and telling him he was crackerjack. As he did so, he thought he saw Judy's pale face and big pale eyes behind their serious spectacles, watching him from the centre of the crowd. "My father needed me," he wanted to explain to her. "I forgot where the bus stop was. I lost your phone number. I did it for my country." The Bentley was waiting at the front steps, cuddle over the door. Riding away at Rick's side, Pym imagined he heard Judy calling out his name. "Pym, you bastard. Where are you?" It was dawn. Unshaven, Pym sat at his desk, not wanting the daylight. Chin in hand, he stared at the last page he had written. "Change nothing. Don't look back. Don't look forward. You do it once, then die." A miserable vision assailed him of the women in his life, vainly waiting at every bus stop along his chaotic path. Rising quickly, he mixed himself a Nescafe and drank it while it was still too hot for him. Then took up his stapler and marker pen and set himself busily to work. "I am a clerk. That is all I am." Stapling his cuttings and cross-indexing the helpful references. Extracts from Gulworth Mercury and Evening Star, reporting Liberal candidates fighting stand on eve of poll night in the town hall. For libel reasons, writers omit direct reference to Peggy Wentworth's accusations, referring only to candidates' spirited self-defense against personal attack. Enter at 21A. "Bloody stapler doesn't work. This sea air rusts everything." Cutting from London Times, giving results of Gulworth North by-election. McKechnie, Labour, 17,970. Lakin, Conservative, 15,711. Pym, Liberal, 6,404. Semi-literate leader ascribes victory to miscalculated intervention of liberals. Enter at 22A. Extract from Oxford University Gazette, notifying Waiting World that Magnus Richard Pym has been awarded a BA Honours degree in Modern Languages, Class 1. No reference to night hours spent studying previous examination papers, or informal exploration of tutor's desk drawers with the aid of the Michael's ever-handy steel dividers. Entered at 23A. But actually not entered at all, for in the act of marking this cutting, Pym set it down before him and stared at it, head in hands, with an expression of revulsion. Rick knew. The bastard knew. His head still between his hands, Pym returns himself to Gulworth later the same night. Father and son are riding in the Bentley, their favourite place. The town hall lies behind them. Mrs. Searle's temperance rest is approaching. The tumult of the crowd still rings in their ears. It will be another 24 hours before the world will learn the name of the winning candidate, but Rick knows it already. He has been judged and applauded for all his life till now. "Let me tell you something, old son," he says, in his mellowest and kindest voice. The passing streetlights are switching his wise features on and off, making his triumph appear intermittent. "Never lie, son. I told them the truth. God heard me. He always does." "It was fantastic," says Pym. "Could you possibly let go of my arm, please?" "No Pym was ever a liar, son." "I know," says Pym, taking back his arm anyway. "Why couldn't you have come to me, son? Father, you could have said. Ricky, if you like, you're old enough. I'm not reading law any more. I'm building up my languages because I want the gift of tongues. I want to go out into the world like my best pal and be heard wherever men gather, regardless of colour, race or creed. Because do you know what I'd have answered if you'd come to me and said that to your old man?" Pym is too mad, too dead to care. "You'd have been super," he says. "I'd have said, son, you're grown up now. You take your own decisions. All your old man can do is play wicket-keeper while Magnus here bats and God does the bowling." He grasps Pym's hand, nearly breaking his fingers. "Don't shrink away from me like that, old son. I'm not angry with you. We're pals, remember? We don't have to tiptoe round each other looking in one another's pockets, poking in drawers, talking to misguided women in hotel cellars. We come out with it straight on the table. Now dry those old peepers of yours and give your old pal a hug." With his monogrammed silk handkerchief, the great statesman magnanimously wipes away the tears of Pym's rage and impotence. "Want a good English steak tonight, son?" "Not much." "Old Matty's cooking us one with onions. You can invite Judy if you like. We'll all have a game of chamois afterwards. She'd like that." Raising his head, Pym recovered his marker pen and went back to work. Extract of branch minutes of Oxford University Communist Party. Regretting departure of Comrade M. Pym. Tireless worker on behalf of cause. Fraternal thanks for his tremendous efforts. Entered at 24A. Penned letter from bursar of Pym's college, enclosing his cheque for his last term's battles, marked "Refer to Drawer." Similar letter and cheques from Messrs. Blackwell, Parker, booksellers, and Hall Brothers, tailors. Entered at 24C. Penned letter from Pym's bank manager, regretting that following return of cheque drawn in Pym's favour by the Magnus Dynamic and Astral Company, Bahamas Limited, in the sum of £250, he has had no alternative but to refer to drawer the cheques as at 24C. Extract from London Gazette, dated 29th March 1951, appointing official receiver in yet another petition for bankruptcy of RTP and 83 associated companies. Letter from Director of Public Prosecutions inviting Pym to present himself for interview on named date in order to explain his relationship with above companies. Entered at 36A. Military call-up papers offering Pym sanctuary. Grabbed with both hands. "If I could just sit with you for a bit, Miss D," said Pym, softly pushing open her kitchen door. But her chair was empty, and the fire out. It was not evening, as he had thought, but dawn. Chapter 12. It was the same dawn. It was time minus 10 minutes. It was the moment Brotherhood had lain wakeful and alone for in his rotten flat that was becoming a solitary cell for him, staring at the images of his past in the restless London sky. It was an outdoor game being played by indoor people who didn't know they were awake. How many times had he sat like this, in rubber boats, on Arctic hillsides, pressing the headphones into his ears with kapok mittens to catch the whisper that meant life was not extinct? Here in the communications room on the top floor of head office, there were no headphones, no sub-zero winds to rip through sodden clothing and freeze the operator's fingers off, no bicycle generator that some poor bastard had to pump at till his legs failed, no aerial that collapsed on you when you most needed it, no two-ton suitcase to be cached in iron-hard soil while the Huns were breathing down your neck. Up here we have dimpled grey-green boxes, freshly dusted, with pretty pin lights and shiny switches, and tuners and amplifiers, and dials to cut out atmospherics, and comfortable chairs for the barons here assembled to rest their candy arses on, and a mysterious compression of the air that clenches your scalp while you watch the green numerals sliding through their prison window as quickly as the later years of life. Now I am 40, now I am 45, now I am 70, now I am 10 minutes to being dead. On the raised platform, two boys in headphones were patrolling the dials. They'll never know what it was like, thought Brotherhood. They'll go to their graves thinking life came out of a packet. Beau Bramall and Nigel sat below them like producers at a preview. Behind them, a dozen shadows that Brotherhood had barely bothered with. He noticed Lorimer, head of operations. He saw Kate and thought, thank heaven she's alive. At the edge of the stage, Frankel was lugubriously reporting a string of failures. His mid-European accent had thickened. 9:20 yesterday morning, local time. Prague station has its chief cutout dial the watchman household from a call box, Beau, he said. Number engaged. He makes 5 calls in 2 hours from round town. Still engaged. He tries conga. Number out of order. Everybody vanished. Everybody out of touch. Midday, the station sends a little girl they own to the canteen where Conga's daughter goes for lunch. Conga's daughter is conscious, so maybe she knows where her father is. Our little girl is a 16-year-old kid, very small, very hardy. She hangs around 2 hours, checks both sittings, checks the queue. No daughter. She checks the attendance sheets at the factory gate, tells the guard she is the daughter's roommate. She's so innocent, they let her. Conga's daughter is not reported present, is not reported sick-listed. Vanished. In the tension, nobody spoke to anybody. Everyone spoke to himself. The room was still filling up. How many people does it take to give a network a decent burial? Thought Brotherhood. 8 minutes to go. Frankel continued his dirge. 7 o'clock yesterday morning, local time, Gdansk station puts 2 of their local boys to mend a telegraph pole at the end of the street where Merriman lives. His house is in a cul-de-sac. He's got no other way out. Every day normally he goes to work by car, leaves his house 7:20. But yesterday his car is not outside his house. Every other day it is parked outside his house, not yesterday. From where the boys work they can see his front door. The front door stays closed. No Merriman. Nobody at all leaves or enters that house by that door. Downstairs is curtained, no lights, no fresh tracks in the drive. Merriman's good friend is an architect. Merriman likes to take a coffee with him sometimes on his way to work. This architect is not a Joe. He is not whitelisted. Wenzel is the architect's name, Jack. One of the boys calls up Mr. Wenzel and tells him Merriman's mother is ill. Where can I get hold of him to give him this bad news? He says. Mr. Wenzel says try the laboratory. How ill? The boy says she's maybe dying. Merriman ought to get to her fast. Give him this message, the boy says. Tell him, please, that Maximilian says he'd better get to his mother's bedside fast. Maximilian, that's the code word for it's all over. Maximilian means abort. Means run, means get the hell out by any known means. Don't bother with the customary procedures. Run. The boy is resourceful. When he has ceased to speak to Mr. Wenzel, he calls the laboratory where Merriman works. This is Mr. Maximilian. Where's Merriman? It's urgent. Tell him Maximilian got to speak to him about his mother. Merriman don't come in today, they tell him. Merriman got a conference in Warsaw. Brotherhood was already objecting. They wouldn't say that, he growled. The labs don't give out details of staff movements. They're a top secret installation, for Christ's sake. Somebody's playing games with us. Sure, Jack, my own reaction entirely. You want I go on? A couple of heads turn to locate Brotherhood at the back of the room. When the line to Merriman went dead, we instructed Warsaw to try to reach Voltaire direct, Frankel continued. He paused. Voltaire is sick. Brotherhood let out an angry laugh. Voltaire? He hasn't had a day's sickness in his life. His ministry says he's sick, Jack. His wife says he's sick. His mistress says he's sick. He had some bad mushrooms, gone to hospital. He's sick. Official. They all say the same. I'll say it's official. What do you want me to do, Jack? Tell me something I should do that you would do yourself and I have not done. Okay? It's a blackout, Jack. Like a silence everywhere. Like a bomb fell. You said you'd keep filling the letterboxes, Brotherhood said. We filled for Merriman yesterday. Money and instructions. We filled. So what happened? Still there. Money and instructions. So much you want. Fresh papers, maps, you name it. For Conga, we put up two visuals. One for callers, one for evacuate. One curtain on a first floor, one light in a basement window. Is that correct, Jack? Does that accord with the agreed procedures? It accords. Okay, so he doesn't answer, he doesn't call, he doesn't write, he doesn't run. For 5 minutes there was no sound but the sounds of waiting, the sighing of soft chairs, the striking of lights and matches, and the squeaky-soled footsteps of the boys. Kate glanced at Brotherhood, and he smiled confidence back. Beau said, "We're thinking of you, Jack." But Brotherhood did not reply, and he was certainly not thinking of Beau. A bell rang. From the platform, a boy said, "Conga, sir, on schedule," and trimmed some dials. A white pin light winked above his head. The second boy dropped a switch. Nobody clapped, nobody got to his feet, or cried, "They're alive." "Conga operator's come in and says he's ready to send, Bo," Frankel said, gratuitously. Behind him, the boys were moving automatically, deaf to everything outside their headphones. "Now, we make our first transmission. We use all tape, no handwriting. Conga does the same. Accelerated Morse. We unroll it both ends. Transmission takes maybe 1.5 minutes, 2. Unroll and decode takes maybe 5. See that? We are ready to receive you. Talk." This is what we say to him. "Now Conga is talking again. Watch the red light left, please. It burns. He's talking. He's finished." "Wasn't very long, was it?" Lorimer drawled, not to anyone in particular. Lorimer had buried agents before. "Now we wait for the decode," Frankel told his audience, a little too brightly. 3 minutes, maybe 5. Time to smoke a cigarette, okay? Everybody relax. Conga's alive and well." The boys were transferring spools, resetting instruments. "Let's just be grateful he's alive," said Kate. And several heads turned sharply, remarking this unaccustomed display of feeling from a fifth-floor lady. The grey spools were rolling one onto the other. For a moment they heard the unrhythmic piping of Morse code. It stopped. "Hey," said Lorimer softly. "Run it through again," said Brotherhood. "What's happened?" said Kate. The boys rewound the spools and switched again to forward. The Morse resumed and stopped as before. "Could it be a fault the other end?" Lorimer asked. "Sure," Frankel said. Possible his winder's on the blink. Possible he hit some bad ionosphere. In a minute he comes through again. No problem. The taller of the two boys was pulling off his headphones.
Mind if we decode, Mr. Frankel? He said. Sometimes when they've got a hitch, they tell us about it in the message.
On a nod from Frankel, he shifted a spool to a machine at the far end of the bank. The printer began chattering immediately. Nigel and Lorimer moved quickly towards the platform. The printer stopped. Nigel magisterially ripped out the sheet and held it for Lorimer and himself to read. Brotherhood was already striding down the aisle. Mounting the platform, he snatched the script from their unresisting hands.
Jack, don't, said Kate, under her breath.
Don't what? Brotherhood said, suddenly out of patience with her.
Don't care about my own agents.
Don't do what exactly?
Tell them to print another copy, will you, Frankel? Nigel said smoothly. Then we can all look at it together without shoving.
Brotherhood was holding the sheet before him. Nigel and Lorimer had meekly arranged themselves to either side of him and were reading it over his shoulder. Routine intelligence report, Beau, Nigel announced, reading aloud. Promised length, 307 groups. Actual length so far, 41. Subject, restationing of Soviet missile bases in mountains north of Pilsen. Subsource Mirabeau reporting 10 days ago. Mirabeau in turn reporting her Soviet army boyfriend, codename Leo. Leo's done us rather well in the past, I seem to remember. Message reads as follows. Subsource Talleyrand confirms empty low loaders leaving area. Message ends in mid-sentence. Obviously the winder. Unless, as you say, his signal hit freak conditions. Frankel was already giving orders to the taller boy. Send them your signal garbled. Do it immediately. Tell them we want a rerun. Tell them if they can't transmit now, we'll remain on standby till they can. Tell them we want a roll call of all members of the network. You got set phrases for that, or you want I draft something?
Tell them damn all,
Brotherhood ordered, very loud.
And stop crying, everybody. No one's hurt.
He had thrust his hands into his raincoat pockets. He was halfway down the aisle. Nigel and Lorimer were still on stage, a pair of choir boys clutching their hymn sheet between them. Bramall sat stoically upright in the auditorium. Kate was staring at him, not stoical at all.
You can tell them you want a roll call or a rerun. You can tell them to abort. You can tell them to jump in the Vistula. It doesn't make a dime of difference, said Brotherhood.
Poor man, said Nigel to Lorimer. They're his Joes, you see. It's the strain.
They're not my Joes, and they never were. You can have them with my blessing.
He looked around him for men with sense.
Frankel, for Christ's sake, Lorimer, when this service catches someone else's Joe, if it ever does these days, what does it do? If he's willing to be played, we play him back. If he's not, we send him to the tower. Is it different now? I wouldn't know.
So, said Nigel, humouring him, if we decide to play him back, we do it as naturally and as fast as we can. Why? Because we want to show the opposition that nothing has changed. We want it seamless. We don't hide his car and close his house. We don't let him or his daughter or anybody else vanish into thin air. We don't ignore dead letterboxes or invent fatuous stories about people eating bad mushrooms. We don't sandbag radio operators in the middle of their high-speed transmissions. That is the last, the very last thing we do. Unless...
I don't read you, Jack, old boy, Nigel said, whom Brotherhood had deliberately ignored.
I don't think anybody does, to be truthful.
I think you are very naturally upset, and you are getting a bit metaphysical, if you don't mind me saying.
Unless what, Jack, said Frankel.
Unless we want the opposition to know we're rolling up their network.
But why would anybody want that, Jack? Frankel asked earnestly.
Explain to us, please.
Why not explain it another time, said Nigel.
There never was a bloody network. They owned those networks from day one. They paid the actors, wrote the script. They owned Pym, and near enough they owned me. They owned all of you as well. You just haven't woken up to it.
Then why do they bother to tell us anything at all? Frankel objected. Why send us a fake interrupted signal? Why rig the disappearance of the Joes? Brotherhood smiled. Not kindly, not with humour. But he did turn to Frankel, and he did smile at him.
Because, old boy, they want us to think they've got Pym when they haven't, he said. That's the only lie they've got left to sell us. They want us to call off the hunt and go home to our high tea. They want to find him for themselves. That's the good news of the day. Pym is still on the run, and they want him as much as we do.
They watched him turn and stride down the aisle, and slide the locks on the padded door. Poor old Jack, they said to each other, with their eyes as the lights went up. His life's work, lost all his Joes and can't face it. Dreadful to see him so cut up. Only Frankel seemed to wish he hadn't gone.
Have you ordered the rerun yet? Said Nigel. I said, have you ordered the rerun?
I'll do it now, said Frankel.
Good man, said Beau appreciatively from the stalls. In the corridor, Brotherhood paused to light himself a cigarette. The door opened and closed again. It was Kate.
I can't go on, she said. It's mad.
Well, it's going to get a damn sight madder, snapped Brotherhood, still angry. That was just the trailer. It was night once more, and Mary had got through another day without throwing herself politely from a top-floor window or scrawling filthy words on the dining-room walls. Seated on her bed, still moderately sober, she stared at the book and then at the phone. The phone had a second wire fed into it. The wire led to a grey box and seemed to stop.
Since my time, she thought. Can't be doing with these modern gadgets.
She poured another generous tot of whiskey and set the glass on the table at her elbow, in order to end the argument she had been having with herself for the last 10 minutes.
There you are, damn you. If you want one, have one. If you don't, leave the bloody thing where it is.
She was fully dressed. She was supposed to have a headache, but the headache was a lie to escape the excruciating company of Fergus and the girl, Georgie, who had begun to treat her with the deference of warders before her hanging.
How about a nice game of Scrabble, Mary? Not in the mood, are we? Never mind.
I say, that shepherd's pie did go down a treat, didn't it, Georgie? I haven't had a shepherd's pie like that since my nan went. Do you think it's the freezing that does it? Sort of ripens it, does it, the freezing?
At 11 o'clock, screaming inside, she had left them to the washing up, and brought herself up here to the book, and to the note that had accompanied it. A deckled card.
Silver-edged, my wedding anniversary. In a deckled envelope. Vile cherub blowing trumpet, top left. Dear Mary, so sorry to hear about M's calamity. Picked this up for pennies this morning, and wondered whether you would like to bind it for me, same as all the others, full hide buckram, and the title printed in gold capitals between the first and second band on the spine. The end papers look kind of new to me. Maybe just writ them out? Grant's away too, so I guess I know how you feel. Could you do it quickly as a surprise for him? Usual fee, of course. My love, darling. B.
Keeping her hand away from the whiskey and her mind clear of thoughts of a certain moustached phantom, Mary applied her training to the note. The handwriting was not B. Lederer's. It was a forgery, and to anyone who knew the game, a dismal one. The writer had paid lip service to B.'s all-American copperplate, but the Germanic influence was clear in the spiky U's and N's, and the T's without tails.
Weather. Instead of if, she thought. When did an American write weather?
The spelling wasn't B's either. A word like calamity. B couldn't spell for toffee. She doubled every consonant on sight. Her letters to Mary in Greece, penned on similar stationery, had contained such family gems as manipulate and fallacy. As to full hide, Mary had bound just 3 books for B, and B hadn't known from green apples how she wanted them, except she thought they looked great on Grant's shelf. Just like the old libraries you have in England. Full hide, buckram, the placing of the lettering. These were the writer talking, not B. And if B suspected that the end papers might not be original, well, bully for B. Because a month ago she had asked Mary, wherever had she bought that cute wallpaper stuff she stuck on the inside of her covers?